got pictures. Let's not push our luck, said Sam.
Agreed, replied Dom. I'm tired of watching other people eat lunch. Let's go find some food.
Rice and lamb? Asked Sam morosely.
Better. I saw McDonald's by the metro.
McLamb it is.
5.
Jack Ryan Jr. pulled his Hummer into his designated parking space in the lot of Henley Associates at 5:10 a.m. He struggled to climb out of the big vehicle. His muscles ached. Cuts and bruises covered his arms and legs. He limped through the back door of the building. He did not like coming in so early, especially considering how beat up he was this morning. But he had important work that could not wait. At this moment, there were 4 operatives in the field, and although he truly wished he were out there with them, Ryan knew it was his responsibility to provide them the best real-time intelligence he could in order to make their tough work, if not easier, at least not any harder than it needed to be. He passed a security man at the reception desk in the lobby. As far as Jack was concerned, the guard was freakishly awake and alert at this rude hour.
Morning, Mr. Ryan.
Hey, Bill.
Normally, Ryan didn't come in until 8, and by then, Bill, a retired Air Force Security Force Master Sergeant, had handed off his post to Ernie. Ryan had met Bill only a couple of times, but he seemed like he was born to do his job. Jack Jr. took the elevator up, shuffled through the dark hallway, dropped his leather messenger bag off in his cubicle, and headed for the kitchen. There, he started a pot of coffee, and then reached into the freezer and pulled out an ice pack that had been getting a lot of use of late. Back at his desk while the coffee brewed, he lit up his computer and flipped on the lamp. Other than Jack, some IT guys who worked 24/7, a third shift analytical translation unit, and the security men on the first floor, the building would be dead for at least another hour. Jack sat, held the ice to his jaw, and put his head down on his desk.
Shit, he mumbled.
5 minutes later, the coffee maker dripped its last drop into the pot, just as Ryan grabbed a mug from the cabinet. He poured steaming black liquid into it and hobbled back to his desk. He wanted to go back home and lie down, but that was not an option. The after-hours training Ryan had been going through was kicking his ass, but he knew he wasn't in any real danger. His colleagues out in the field were the ones in peril, and it was his job to help them out. And his tool to help them was his computer. More specifically, it was the data that the parabolic dishes on the roof and the antenna farm of Henley Associates pulled out of the ether. The data the codebreakers and a mainframe supercomputer decoded from the near constant hall of encrypted information. Jack's daily morning fishing expedition derived its fish from data traffic from CIA in Langley, from the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, from the National Counterterrorism Center at Liberty Crossing in McLean, from the FBI in D.C., and from a host of other agencies. Today he saw he had a particularly large pull to go through, even this early in the morning. Much of it was traffic that came to Langley from friendly nations overseas, and this is what he'd arrived early to peruse. Jack logged into the NSA's Executive Intercept Transcript first. The XITs, or ZITs, would alert him to any big goings-on that he had missed since leaving work at 6 the previous afternoon. As his screen began filling with data, he took mental stock of what was going on today. The operational tempo, or op-tempo, here at the campus, had been going up precipitously in the past few weeks, so Jack found it harder and harder each morning to decide on a starting place for his day's duties. The 4 campus operatives out in the field were divided into 2 teams. Jack Jr.'s cousin, Dominic Caruso, was teamed with ex-Army Ranger Sam Driscoll. They were in Cairo, tailing a Muslim Brotherhood operative who, Jack and his fellow analysts at the campus had reason to suspect, was doing his best to raise some hell. According to the CIA, the man had been setting up training camps in western Egypt and was purchasing weapons and ammunition from a source in the Egyptian army. After that, well, that was the problem. No one had been able to figure out what he was doing with the camps and the guns and the know-how he'd obtained working for the URC and other groups for the past 2 decades. All they knew was that he and his camps and his guns were in Egypt. Jack sighed. Egypt. Post-Mubarak. Pre-fucked-up free-fire zone? The American media declared as fact that the changes in the Middle East would promote peace and tranquility. But Ryan, the campus, and a lot of people in the know around the world thought it likely that the changes in the Middle East would usher in not moderation, but rather, extremism. To many in the American media, people who thought such things were pessimists at best, and bigots at worst. Ryan considered himself a realist, and for this reason he didn't run out into the street to praise the rapid change. The extremists were out in force. With the disappearance of the emir nearly a year earlier, all over the map the terrorists were shifting safe houses, allegiances, occupations, and even host nations. One thing hadn't changed, though. Ground zero for the entire jihadist movement was still Pakistan. 30 years ago, all the fledgling jihadists of the world flocked there to fight the Russians. Every male kid in the Islamic world past the age of puberty was offered a gun and an express ticket to paradise. Every boy younger than that was offered a place in a madrasa, a religious school that fed them and clothed them and gave them a community. But the madrasas set up in Pakistan taught only extremist beliefs and war-fighting skills. These skills were handy for the students, as these children were just being made ready to send into Afghanistan to fight the Russians. But the skill sets they'd learned, along with the madrasa's promotion of jihad, didn't leave them many options when the Russians left. It was inevitable that when the Soviets quit Afghanistan, the hundreds of thousands of armed and angry jihadists in Pakistan would become an incredible thorn in the side of the government there. And it was equally inevitable that these armed and angry jihadists would push into the vacuum that was post-Soviet Afghanistan. And thus began the story of the Taliban, which created the safe haven for Al-Qaeda, which brought Western coalition forces over a decade earlier. Ryan sipped his coffee, tried to focus his thoughts back on his duties and away from the big geopolitical issues that governed all. When his dad made it back into the White House, then his dad would have all that to worry about. Junior, on the other hand, had to deal with the comparatively tiny day-to-day ramifications of all those big problems. Small stuff, like IDing some mutt for Sam and Dom. They had emailed him another batch of pictures for him to look at. Pictures including some of the unknown Pakistani who had met with El-Dabusi the day before. Ryan forwarded that email to Tony Wills, the analyst who worked in the cubicle next to Jack's. Tony would work on IDing the subject. For now, Jack knew he needed to concentrate on the other team in the field, John Clark and Domingo Chavez. Ding and John were in Europe at the moment, in Frankfurt, and they were mulling over their options. They'd spent the last 2 days preparing a surveillance operation to monitor an Al-Qaeda banker who would be heading into Luxembourg for some meetings, but the man canceled his trip from Islamabad at the last minute. The men were all dressed up, with no place to go, so Jack decided he'd spend some time this morning digging deeper into the background of the European bankers the URC man planned on meeting with, in the hopes of getting a fresh lead for his colleagues in Europe to check out before they packed up and came home. For this reason, Jack had rolled into work much earlier than usual. He did not want them to return with nothing to show for their trip. It was his responsibility to feed them the intel they needed to find the bad guys, and he'd spend the next few hours trying to find them some bad guys. He scanned through the zits and a proprietary software program created by Gavin Byerie, the campus's head of IT. Gavin's catcher program searched data strings following the wishes of the analysts here at the campus. It allowed them to filter out much of the intelligence that was not relevant to their current projects, and for Jack, this software had been a godsend. Ryan opened a series of files with clicks of his mouse. While he did this, he marveled at the number of tidbits of intelligence that were coming on a one-way street from U.S. allies these days. It depressed him a little. Not because he didn't want America's allies to share intel. Rather, he was bothered because these days, it was not a two-way street. To most in the U.S. intelligence community, it was an outrageous scandal that President Edward Kielty and his political appointees and top intelligence posts had spent the past 4 years degrading the U.S.'s abilities to unilaterally spy on other countries. Kielty and his people had instead shifted the focus of intelligence gathering, relying not on America's own robust spy services, but instead relying on the intelligence services in foreign nations to provide information to the CIA. This was safer politically and diplomatically, Kielty correctly determined, although diminishing America's spy services was unsafe in every other respect. The administration had all but precluded non-official cover operators from working in allied nations, and CIA clandestine services people functioning in overseas embassies found themselves hamstrung with even more rules and regs, which made the already difficult dance of their work nearly impossible. The Kielty administration had promised more openness and transparency in the clandestine CIA. Jack Jr.'s father had written an op-ed in the Washington Post that suggested, in a manner that was still respectful to the office of the presidency, that Ed Kielty might want to look up the word clandestine in the dictionary. Kielty's intel appointees had eschewed human intelligence, instead stressing signals intelligence and electronic intelligence. Spy satellites and drones were far, far safer from a diplomatic standpoint, so these technologies were implemented more than ever. Needless to say, longtime CIA human specialists complained, quite rightly saying that although drones do a spectacular job showing us the top of an enemy's head, they were inferior to human assets, who often could tell us what was inside the enemy's head. But these human proponents were seen by many as dinosaurs, and their arguments were ignored. Oh well, Ryan thought. Dad will be in charge in a few months, he was sure of it, and he hoped most or all of the damage done could be undone during his father's 4-year term. He pushed these thoughts out of his head so he could concentrate, and he took a long swig of quickly cooling coffee to help his still sleepy mind focus. He kept clicking on the one-way overnight intelligence hall, paying special attention to Europe, as that was where Chavez and Clark were right now. Wait. Here was something new. Ryan opened a file that sat in the inbox of an analyst at CIA's OREA, the Office of Russian and European Analysis. Jack scanned it quickly, but something piqued his interest, so he went back and read it word for word. Apparently someone at DCRI, the French internal security arm, was letting a colleague at CIA know that they'd gotten a tip that a person of interest would be arriving at Charles de Gaulle that afternoon. Not a big deal in itself, and certainly not something that would have been pushed into one of Jack's queries on its own, except for a name. The French intelligence source, not described in the message to CIA but likely some form of SIGINT or HUMINT, gave them reason to suspect the POI, a man only known to the French as Omar 8, was a recruiter for the Umayyad Revolutionary Council. DCRI heard he would touch down at Charles de Gaulle Airport at 1:10 that afternoon on an Air France flight from Tunis, and then he would be picked up by local associates and taken to an apartment in Seine-Saint-Denis, not far from the airport. It looked to Jack like the Frenchies did not know much about this Omar 8. They suspected he was URC, but he wasn't someone they were particularly interested in themselves. The CIA didn't know much about him either, so little that the analyst at OREA had not even replied yet or forwarded the message to Paris Station. Neither the CIA nor the DCRI had much information on this POI, but Jack Ryan Jr. knew all about Omar 8. Ryan had gotten his intelligence straight from the horse's mouth. Saif Rahman Yassin, a.k.a. the Emir, gave up Omar 8's identity the previous spring while under interrogation by the campus. Jack thought about that for a second. Interrogation? No. It was torture. No sense calling it anything else. Still, in this case anyway, it had been effective. Effective enough to know Omar 8's real name was Hosni Ihebroki. Effective enough to know he was a 33-year-old Tunisian. And effective enough to know he was not a recruiter for the URC. He was a lieutenant in their operational wing. Jack immediately found it odd that this guy would be in France. Jack had read Roki's file many times, as he had read the files of all the known players in all the major terrorist organizations. The guy was not known to ever leave Yemen or Pakistan, except for rare trips home to Tunis. But here he was, flying into Paris under a known alias. Weird. Jack was excited by this nugget of intel. No, Hosni Roki was no big fish in the world of international terror. These days, after the incredible degradation of the URC brought on by the campus, there was only one URC operative who could be considered a serious player on an international level. That man's name was Abdul bin Mohammed al-Qahtani, and he was the operational wing commander of the organization. Ryan would give anything for a shot at al-Qahtani. Roki was no al-Qahtani, but, wandering around France, so far from his normal area of operations, he was certainly interesting. On a whim, Jack clicked open a folder on his desktop that contained a subfolder on each and every terrorist, suspected terrorist, cutout, etc. This was not the database used by the intelligence community at large. Virtually all federal agencies used the TIDE, the Terrorist Identities Datamart environment. Ryan had access to this massive file system, but he found it unwieldy and populated with way too many nobodies to be of any use to him. He referred to the TIDE when he was building his own folder, or Rogue's Gallery as he called it, but only for specific information on specific subjects. Most of the rest of the data for his Rogue's Gallery was his own research, with odds and ends added on by his fellow analysts here at the campus. It was a tremendous amount of work, but the effort itself had already paid dividends. As often as not, Jack found himself not needing to check his folder, because in the preparation of the files, he had committed the vast majority of this information to memory, and he allowed himself to forget a tidbit of intel only once the man or woman had been confirmed dead by multiple reliable sources. But since Roki was not a rock star, Ryan did not remember all of the man's specs. So he clicked on Hosni Roki's folder, took a look at the pictures of his face, scrolled down the data sheet, and confirmed what he already knew. As far as any Western intelligence agency was aware, Roki had never been to Europe. Jack then opened the folder of Abdul bin Mohammed al-Qahtani. There was only one picture on file. It was a few years old, but the resolution was good. Jack didn't bother reading the data sheet on this guy because Jack had written it himself. No Western intelligence agency had known anything about al-Qahtani until after the capture and interrogation of the emir. Once the man's name and occupation passed the emir's lips, Ryan and the other analysts at the campus went to work piecing together the history of the man. Jack himself took the lead on the project, and it was something he couldn't take much pride in, since the information they'd managed to compile after a year of work was so goddamn thin. Al-Qahtani had always been camera and media shy, but he became incredibly elusive after the disappearance of the emir. Once they knew who he was, he seemed to just drop off the map. He'd stayed in the dark for the past year, until last week, that is, when fellow campus analyst Tony Wills uncovered a coded posting on a jihadist website claiming al-Qahtani had called for reprisals against European nations, namely France, for passing laws outlawing the wearing of burqas and headscarves. The campus distributed that intel, covertly of course, back out to the intelligence community at large. Ryan connected the dots, such as they were. The head of URC Ops wants to strike out at France, and within a week, a junior achiever in the organization shows up in country, apparently to meet with others. Tenuous. Tenuous at best. Certainly not something that would normally make Ryan move operators to the area. Under normal circumstances, after this sighting, he and his co-workers would just make a point of monitoring French intelligence feeds and CIA Paris station traffic to see if anything else developed during Hosni Roki's European vacation. But Ryan knew Clark and Chavez were in Frankfurt just a quick hop away. Further, they were geared up and ready to go for a surveillance op. Should he send them to Paris to try and learn something from Roki's movements or contacts? Yes. Hell, it was a no-brainer. A URC goon out in the open? The campus might as well find out what he was up to. Jack grabbed his phone and pushed a 2-digit code. It would be just after noon in Frankfurt. While he waited for the connection to be made, Jack picked up his melting ice pack and held it to the back of his sore neck. John Clark answered on the first ring. Hey, John, it's Jack. Something popped up. It's not going to knock your socks off, but it looks semi-promising. How do you feel about taking a side trip to Paris? 6. 100 miles south of Denver, Colorado, on Highway 67, a 640-acre complex of buildings, towers, and fences sprawls across the flatlands in the shadows of the Rocky Mountains. Its official name is the Florence Federal Correctional Complex, and its designation in the nomenclature of the Bureau of Prisons is United States Penitentiary Administrative Maximum, ADX Florence. The Bureau of Prisons classifies its 114 prisons into 5 levels of security, and ADX Florence is alone at the top of this list. It is also in the Guinness World Records as the most secure prison in the world. It is America's tightest supermax prison, where the most dangerous, the most deadly, and the hardest to hold prisoners are locked away. Among the security measures are laser tripwires, motion detectors, night vision capable cameras, automatic doors and fences, guard dogs, and armed guards. No one has ever escaped from ADX Florence. It is unlikely anyone has even escaped a cell at ADX Florence. But as difficult as it is to get out of the Alcatraz of the Rockies, it is perhaps equally hard to get in. There are fewer than 500 inmates at Florence, out of a total U.S. federal prison population of more than 210,000. Most regular federal prisoners could more easily find acceptance to Harvard than Florence. 90% of ADX Florence's convicts are men who have been taken out of the population of other prisons because they pose a danger to others. The other 10% are high-profile or special-risk inmates. They are housed predominantly in general population units that keep the inmates in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day, but allow a level of non-physical contact among the inmates and, via visits, mail, and phone calls, the outside world. Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, is in the General Population D unit, along with Oklahoma City conspirator Terry Nichols and Olympic bomber Eric Robert Rudolph. Mexican drug lord Francisco El Titi Arellano is housed at Florence in the general population as well, as is Lucchese mob family underboss Anthony Gaspipe Casso, and Robert Philip Hansen, the FBI traitor who sold American secrets to the Soviet Union and then Russia for 2 decades. The H unit is more restrictive, more solitary, and here inmates face SAMs, Special Administrative Measures, Bureau of Prisons parlance for the rules for housing the especially difficult cases. In all of the federal prison systems, there are fewer than 60 inmates under SAMs, and more than 40 of them are terrorists. Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, spent many years in H until moving into D after good behavior and high-profile lawsuits. Omar Adel Rahman, the blind sheik, is in H unit, as is Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker. Ramzi Yosef, the leader of the cell that detonated the bomb in the World Trade Center in 1993, splits his time between H and even more restrictive quarters, depending on his shifting moods and behavior. The men here are allowed just a one-hour visit to a one-man concrete recreation yard that looks like an empty swimming pool, and then only after undergoing a strip search and a walk in cuffs and leg irons while escorted by two guards, one to hold the chains, the other to hold a baton. Still, H unit is not the highest security wing. That is Z unit, the ultra-max disciplinary unit, where the bad boys go to think about their transgressions should they violate any of their SAMs. Here there is no recreation, and no visitors, and minimal contact with even the guards. Remarkably, even Z unit has a special section, where only the worst of the worst are sent. It is called Range 13, and at this moment, only 3 prisoners are housed there. Ramzi Yosef was put here for violations of his SAMs while in Z unit, where he was staying due to violations of his SAMs in H unit. Tommy Silverstein, a 60-year-old career inmate who was convicted of armed robbery in 1977, was put here long ago for killing 2 inmates and a prison guard at another maximum security prison. And a third prisoner, a male inmate who was brought here by masked FBI agents some months prior, only after an existing Range 13 cell was specially sealed off from the rest of the Ultramax subunit, making it even more restrictive. The new cell is known only to Range 13 personnel, and only 2 have seen the new resident's face. He is guarded not by BOP officers, but by a special ad hoc unit from the FBI's hostage rescue team, fully armed and armored paramilitary officers who observe their one prisoner through a glass partition 24 hours a day. The HRT men know the inmate's true identity, but they do not speak it. They, and the few Range 13 personnel who are aware of this odd arrangement at all, refer to the man behind the glass only as register number 09341-000. Prisoner 09341-000 does not have the 12-inch black and white television allowed most other inmates. He is not allowed out of the room to go to the concrete rec yard. Ever. Most inmates are allowed 1 15-minute phone call a week, provided they pay for it out of their own trust fund account, a prison banking system. Prisoner 09341-000 has neither telephone privileges nor a trust fund account. He has neither visitor nor mail privileges either, nor access to the psychological or educational services afforded the other prisoners. His room, his entire world, is 84 square feet, 7 feet by 12 feet. The bed, the desk, and the immovable stool in front of the desk are poured concrete, and other than the toilet-sink combo designed to shut off automatically if intentionally plugged, there are no other furnishings in the cell. A 4-inch-wide window on the back wall of the cell has been bricked over so that the inmate inside has neither a view to the outside nor any natural light. Prisoner 09341-000 is the most solitary prisoner in America, perhaps the world. He is Saif Rahman Yassin, the Emir, the leader of the Umayyad Revolutionary Council, and the terrorist mastermind responsible for the deaths of hundreds in a series of attacks on America and other Western nations, and also the perpetrator of an attack on the West that easily could have killed 100 times that number. The emir climbed up from his prayer rug after his morning salat and sat back on the thin mattress on his concrete bed. He checked the plain white calendar on his desk by his left elbow and saw that today was Tuesday. The calendar had been given to him so that he could hand his laundry out through the electric-operated steel hatch for cleaning at the proper times. Tuesday, Yassin knew, was the day his wool blanket needed to go through the hatch to be cleaned. Dutifully, he rolled it into a tight ball, walked past his steel one-piece toilet and sink unit, took another step that moved him past a shower that worked on a timer so that he would not be able to cover the drain and flood his cell. One more step brought him to the window with the hatch. There, two men in black uniforms, black body armor, and black ski masks stared blankly through the plexiglass back at him. On their chests, MP5 subguns hung at the ready. They wore no badges or insignia at all. Only their eyes were visible. The emir held their gazes, one after the other, for a long moment, his face not more than 2 feet from theirs, though both men were several inches taller. All three sets of eyes broadcast hatred and malevolence. One of the masked men must have said something on the other side of the soundproof glass, because two other masked and armed men sitting at a desk in the back of the viewing room turned their heads toward their prisoner, and one flipped a switch on a console. A loud beep rang out in the emir's cell, and then the small access hatch opened below the window. The emir ignored it, continued the staring contest with his guards. After a few seconds, he heard another beep, and then the amplified voice of the man at the desk came from a speaker recessed in the ceiling above the emir's bed. The masked guard spoke English.
"Put your blanket in the hatch."
The emir did not move. Again.
"Put your blanket in the hatch."
Nothing from the prisoner.
"Last chance."
Now Yassin complied. He had made a small show of resistance, and here that was a victory. The men that had held him in those first weeks after his capture were long gone, and Yassin had been testing the fervency and resolve of his captors ever since. He nodded slowly, dropped his blanket into the hatch, and then the hatch shut. On the other side, one of the two guards close to the window retrieved it, opened it up, and looked it over, and then walked toward the laundry basket. He walked past the basket and tossed the wool blanket into a plastic garbage can. The man at the desk spoke into the microphone again.
"You just lost your blanket, 09341. Keep testing us, asshole. We love this game, and we can play it each and every fucking day."
The microphone switched off with a loud click, and the big guard returned to the glass to shoulder up next to his partner. Together they stood as still as stones, staring through the eye holes in their masks at the man on the other side of the window. The emir turned away and returned to his concrete bed. He would miss that blanket. 7. Melanie Kraft was having an exceptionally bad week. An intelligence reports officer with the Central Intelligence Agency, Melanie was only 2 years out of American University, where she received her BA in International Studies and her Master's in American Foreign Policy. This, augmented with having spent 5 of her teenage years in Egypt as the daughter of an Air Force attaché, made her a nice fit for the CIA. She worked in the Directorate of Intelligence, more specifically, in the Office of Middle East and North Africa Analysis. Principally an Egypt specialist, young Ms. Kraft was bright and eager, so she occasionally reached out a little from her daily duties to work on other projects. It was this willingness to stick out her neck that now threatened to derail a career that was barely 2 years old. Melanie was accustomed to winning, in language classes in Egypt, as a soccer star in high school, and then during her undergrad years, and with perfect grades in school. Her hard work won her fawning appreciation from her professors, and then exemplary performance reviews here at the agency. But all her intellectual and professional success had come to a screeching halt 1 week ago today, when she leaned into her supervisor's office with a paper she had put together on her own time. It was titled, "An Evaluation of Political Rhetoric by the Muslim Brotherhood in English and in Masri." She'd combed English and Egyptian Arabic, Masri, websites to chronicle the growing disconnect between Muslim Brotherhood public relations with the West and their domestic rhetoric. It was a hard-hitting but well-sourced document. She'd spent months of late nights and weekends creating and using phony profiles of Arab men to gain access to password-protected Islamist forums. She'd gained the trust of Egyptians in these cyber coffee shops, and these men let her into the fold, discussed with her Muslim Brotherhood speeches at madrasas across Egypt, even told her of Mobro diplomats going to other nations in the Muslim world to share information with known radicals. She contrasted all she learned with the benevolent facade the Brotherhood was projecting to the West. She finished her paper and handed it over to her immediate supervisor. He sent her in to Phyllis Stark, chief of her department. Phyllis read the title, nodded curtly, and then tossed the brief onto her desk. This frustrated Melanie. She'd expected some show of enthusiasm from her chief. As she'd walked back to her desk, she'd hoped, at least, that her hard work would get passed upstairs. 2 days later, she got her wish. Mrs. Stark had passed it on. Someone had read it, and Melanie Kraft was called into a fourth-floor conference room. Her supervisor, her department chief, and a couple of suits from the seventh floor that she did not recognize were already there when she entered. There was no pretense about the meeting at all. From the looks and gesticulations of the men at the conference table, Melanie Kraft knew she was in trouble even before she sat down.
"Miss Kraft, what is it you thought you would accomplish with your moonlighting? What is it you want?" a seventh-floor political appointee named Pettit asked her.
"Want?
Are you trying to get a new gig around here with your little term paper, or do you just want it to circulate around so that if Ryan wins and brings in his own people, you will be the flavor of the month?"
"No."
That had not occurred to her in the slightest. Theoretically, an administration change should have next to nothing to do with someone at her level in the agency.
"I just had been reading what we've been putting out on the Brotherhood, and I thought it could stand some countervailing data. There is open source intelligence, you'll see in the brief I cited everything, that points to a much more ominous..."
"Miss Kraft, this isn't grad school. I'm not going to check your footnotes."
Melanie did not respond to that, but she didn't bother continuing her defense of her paper either. Pettit continued,
"You have overstepped your boundaries at a time when this agency is at its most polarized."
Kraft didn't think the agency was polarized at all, unless the polarization was between the seventh-floor graybeards who stood to lose their jobs with a Kielty defeat and the seventh-floor graybeards who stood to move into better positions with a Ryan win. That world was far removed from her own, and she would have thought Pettit could have seen that.
"Sir, it was not my intention to cause any rift here in the building. My focus was on the realities in Egypt and the information that was..."
"Did you prepare this document while you were supposed to be working on your daily reports?"
"No, sir, I did this at home."
"We can open an investigation into you to see if you used any classified resources to create..."
100% of the information in that document is open source. My fictitious internet identities were not created from actual agency legends. Honestly, there is nothing I have access to on a daily basis that would have been any help to me in preparing my paper."
"You have a strong opinion that the Brotherhood is nothing but a gang of terrorists."
"No, sir, that is not the conclusion of my paper. The conclusion of my paper is that the rhetoric in the English-speaking world runs counter to the Masri rhetoric put out by the same organization. I think we should just keep track of some of these websites."
"Do you?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you think we should do this because there has been an official finding of some sort? Or you think we should do this because you just think we should do this?"
She did not know how to answer.
"Young lady, the CIA is not a policy-making organization."
Melanie knew this, and the paper was not intended to steer U.S. foreign policy toward Egypt in any direction, but instead to offer a dissenting view to conventional wisdom. Pettit continued,
"Your job is to generate the intelligence product that you are asked to generate. You are not a clandestine services officer. You have stepped out of your lane, and you have done so in a way that looks very suspicious."
"Suspicious?"
Pettit shrugged. He was a politician, and politicians assumed everyone else thought only about politics as well.
"Ryan is ahead in the polls. Melanie Kraft happens to, in her free time no less, create her own covert operation, and thereby shoot off on a tangent that would serve the Ryan Doctrine."
I don't even know what the Ryan Doctrine is. I'm not interested in..."
"Thank you, Miss Kraft. That's all."
She'd walked back to her office, humiliated, but still too confused and angry to cry. But she cried that night back in her little apartment in Alexandria. And there she asked herself why she had done what she'd done. She could see, even at her low level in the organization and with her limited view of the big picture, that the political appointees in the CIA were molding the intelligence product to suit the desires of the White House. Was her brief her own small, bull-headed way to push back against that? In that moment of reflection the night of her fourth-floor meeting, she admitted that it probably was. Melanie's father had been an army colonel who instilled in her a sense of duty as well as a sense of individuality. She grew up reading biographies of great men and women, mostly men and women in the military and government, and she recognized through her readings that no one rose to exceptional greatness exclusively by being a good soldier. No, those few men and women who went against the establishment from time to time, only when necessary, were what ultimately made America great. Melanie Craft had no great ambition other than to stand out from the pack as a winner. Now she was learning another phenomenon about standing out. Nails that stuck out often were hammered back into place. Now she sat in her cubicle, sipping an iced coffee and looking at her screen. She'd been told the day before by her supervisor that her brief had been squashed, destroyed by Pettit and others on the seventh floor. Phyllis Stark had angrily told her the deputy director of the CIA, Charles Alden himself, had read a quarter of it before he tossed it in the trash and asked why the hell the woman who wrote it still had a job. Her friends there at the Office of Middle East and North Africa Analysis felt for her, but they didn't want their own careers to be sidetracked by what they saw as an attempt by their colleague to leapfrog ahead of them by working on intelligence on her own time. So she became the office pariah. Now she was, at 25, thinking about leaving the agency, finding a job in sales somewhere that paid a bit more than her government salary, and getting the hell out of an organization that she loved, but that clearly did not love her back at present. Melanie's desk phone rang, and she saw it was an outside number. She put down the iced coffee and picked up the receiver.
Melanie Craft.
Hi, Melanie, it's Mary Pat Foley at NCTC. Am I catching you at a bad time?
Melanie almost spit her last swallow of coffee across her keyboard. Mary Pat Foley was a legend in the U.S. intelligence community. It was impossible to exaggerate her reputation and the impact her career had had on foreign affairs or on women at CIA. Melanie had never met Mrs. Foley, though she'd seen her speak a dozen times or more, going back to her undergrad days at American. Most recently, Melanie had sat in on a seminar Mary Pat had given to CIA analysts about the work of the National Counterterrorism Center. Melanie stammered out a reply.
Yes, ma'am.
I am catching you at a bad time?
No, excuse me. You aren't catching me at a bad time.
The young analyst kept her voice more professional than her emotions.
How can I help you today, Mrs. Foley?
I wanted to give you a call. I spent the morning reading your brief.
Oh?
Very interesting.
Thank you. How so?
What kind of response are you getting from the graybeards on the seventh floor?
Well, she said as she frantically searched for the right words. Honestly, I'd have to say there has been some pushback.
Mary Pat repeated the word slowly.
Pushback?
Yes, ma'am. I did expect some reticence on the part of...
Can I take that to mean that you are getting your ass kicked over there?
Melanie Craft's mouth hung open for a moment. She finally closed it self-consciously, as if Mrs. Foley were sitting in her cube with her. Finally, she stammered an answer.
I would say I had been taken to the woodshed over my work.
There was a brief pause.
Well, Mrs. Craft, I think your initiative was brilliant.
A return pause, then.
Thank you.
I have a team going over your report, your conclusions, your citations, looking for information relevant to the work we do here. In fact, I'm planning on making it required reading among my staff. Beyond the Egypt angle, it shows how someone can hit a problem from a different slant to shed new light on it. I encourage that for my people over here, so any real-world examples I can find are very helpful to me.
I am very honored.
Phyllis Stark is lucky to have you working for her.
Thank you.
Melanie realized she was just saying thank you over and over, but she was so focused on not saying anything she would regret, it was all that came out.
If you are ever looking for a change of pace, just come and talk to me. We are always on the hunt for analysts who aren't afraid to upset the apple cart by delivering the cold, hard truth.
Suddenly, Melanie Craft came up with something to say.
Would you be available this week sometime?
Mary Pat laughed.
Oh, God, is it that bad over there?
It's like I have leprosy, although I suppose if I had leprosy, I'd at least receive get-well cards.
Damn, Kildee's people over there are a disaster.
Melanie Craft did not respond. She could riff on Foley's comment for an hour, but she held her tongue. That would not be professional, and she did actually consider herself to be apolitical.
Mary Pat said, "Okay, I'd love to meet you. You know where we are?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Call my secretary.
I'm pretty tied up through the week, but come have lunch with me early next week.
Thank you, she said again.
Melanie hung up the phone and, for the first time in a week, she wanted to neither cry nor smash her fist through a wall.
8.
John Clark and Domingo Chavez sat in their Ford minivan and watched the apartment building through the rainy night. Both men held Sig Sauer handguns in their right hands, resting on their thighs. They kept the weapons low in the shadows, but ready for quick use. In their left hands, Clark held thermal binoculars, Chavez a camera with a long-range lens. Crushed plastic coffee cups and gum wrappers filled a plastic bag on the floor below the passenger seat. Though their weapons were drawn, they would do their best to avoid using them. Any shooting that might be necessary tonight would be defensive in nature, and the trouble wasn't likely to come from the terrorist assassin and his pals up the street in their safe house, which, in actuality, was a fourth-floor walk-up tenement flat. No, the immediate threat was the neighborhood itself. For the fifth time in the past 4 hours, a dozen strong crowd of steely-eyed young men passed on the sidewalk next to their vehicle. Chavez took a break from staring through the telephoto lens of his cannon at the lighted entryway of the apartment to watch the men pass. Both he and Clark kept their eyes on the group in their rearview mirror until they disappeared in the rainy night. When they were gone, Chavez rubbed his eyes and glanced around at his surroundings.
This sure isn't postcard Paris.
Clark smiled, reholstering his pistol in the shoulder rig under his oiled canvas jacket.
We're a long way from the Louvre.
They were in the banlieue, the outer suburbs. The safe house was located in a housing project in the not inappropriately named Staines commune, in Seine-Saint-Denis, a banlieue of low-income residents, many of them poor immigrants from Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, North African nations from which France had imported millions of workers in the 20th century. There were housing projects all over Seine-Saint-Denis, but the two Americans had the misfortune tonight to find themselves on the outskirts of one of the roughest. Decrepit, graffiti-festooned concrete apartment buildings lined both sides of the street. Gangs of youth milled about the neighborhood. Cars blaring North African rap music drove by slowly, while rats scurried along the trash-strewn gutters next to the van and disappeared down the iron drains. Earlier, during their afternoon and evening sitting in the minivan, the two Americans noticed that the neighborhood postman wore a helmet, lest items be thrown from the building onto his head just for kicks. And they also noticed that they had not seen one police car in the neighborhood. This part of town was too dangerous to patrol. The Ford Galaxy Clark and Chavez sat in sported torn molding and a dented, rusted body, but its windows and windshield were intact and deeply tinted, all but obscuring the inside of the van. Most strangers in parked cars who sat for long on this street would have been harassed by the locals. But Clark had picked this vehicle out from a budget lot in Frankfurt because, he felt, it would give them the greatest chance for anonymity. That said, it would take only one set of curious eyes to pick out this vehicle, to spend some time looking it up and down, and to realize that it was not from around here. Then the neighborhood heavies would surround it, smash the windows, and then loot and torch it. Chavez and Clark would race off before they let that happen, but they certainly did not want to give up their surveillance on the safe house 200 meters up the street. The Americans had positioned themselves on the avenue at the rear of the building, assuming that even with the bare minimum of tradecraft, the cell would, at least, know not to enter and exit the building on the other side, where there was a high-traffic boulevard and, consequently, many more eyes that could turn their way as they came and went. Clark and Chavez knew that with one vehicle, there was no way to properly stake out their target location. Instead, they decided they would just try to get pictures of whoever came and went. And to that end, Chavez had a Canon EOS Mark II camera with a massive 600mm super telephoto lens that allowed him, with the attached monopod, to get incredibly detailed photographs of anyone who stepped into the lighted doorway at the back of the building in the distance. Pictures would be helpful, but other than that, there was not much they could realistically accomplish here. A surveillance force of at least 4 vehicles and 8 watchers would be needed to make any sort of respectable effort at covering all the access points of this target location. And a 6-vehicle fleet, crewed with 2 men each, would be the bare minimum protocol for mobile surveillance in an urban area like Paris, when working with a target trained in counter-surveillance, as Hosni Iheb Roki certainly was. Chavez and Clark had yet to see Hosni Roki, but the odds looked good that he was, in fact, here. This was the address Ryan passed on from French Internal Security, and they had noticed a few young toughs milling around outside the apartment building like a security cordon. Perhaps URC men, but more likely a local gang hired by the target to act as a tripwire, should any police or other forces come snooping around. And earlier in the evening, just after dark, Chavez had flipped his hoodie up over his short, dark hair, climbed out of the minivan, and performed a half hour of foot reconnaissance. He'd made a wide, arcing circle of the apartment building and strolled through a few parking lots, a playground that looked like it was used these days primarily by glue sniffers and heroin users, and through the ground level of a four-story parking garage. He then made his way back to the maroon Ford Galaxy. Immediately after Chavez climbed in, Clark had asked,
"What's the word?"
"Seen three or four guys downstairs at the back of the building. Four guys at the front entrance, too."
"Anything else?"
"Yep. We aren't the only ones interested in that apartment."
"No?"
"Beige Citroen four-door. This side of the road, in the parking lot on the other side of that building there on the left. Male driver, female passenger, both black in their 30s.
"Surveillance," Clark said.
Chavez wouldn't have mentioned them if they weren't.
"Yeah. They were subtle enough, but they have line of sight on Rookie's place, and we've got eyes on the entrance to that parking lot and didn't see the car arrive, which means they've been there since before we got here. So yeah, they are definitely watchers. Who do you think they are?"
"DCRI would be my first guess. If I'm right about that, then there will be more cars around here. They probably have a surveillance box set up, but I doubt we're inside it. They are probably closer than we are because they won't all need to have eyes on the target. They would just tuck into the parking lots and stay in comms with each other. I'm glad the French are watching these guys, but I sure as hell wish they had some stronger measures on their plate. It would be nice for them to pick Rocky up, give him a shake, and see what falls out."
"Keep dreaming, John. Not the French. The CIA used to do a little of that, before Guilty put the kibosh on offending terrorists."
"Heads up, Ding," John said suddenly.
A pair of young toughs walked by on the left from behind. Both men slowed and looked into the van. John and Ding were somewhat concealed behind the heavy tint, but they were by no means invisible. Clark stared back at the two young African immigrants for a long moment. Then the men walked on. Clark's steely-eyed gaze had won the encounter, but they were prepared if they had to actually talk to the locals. The two American spies never worked any operation without a plausible cover for action, a reason to be in a location other than the actual motive. Both men had worked under so many covers over the years, oftentimes preparing themselves on the fly, that they possessed the abilities of well-trained actors. The cover for this op, should they be pulled out of the vehicle by police or internal security or even a well-armed neighborhood drug gang, was clever in both its simplicity and plausibility. Clark and Chavez were, if anyone demanded to know, American private investigators watching the flat of a woman who cleaned the home of a wealthy American living in the Latin Quarter. According to their story, their employer suspected the cleaning lady of stealing his valuables and then fencing them from her flat. It would bear short-term scrutiny only, but 9 times out of 10, that was enough. One by one, the lights turned off on the fourth floor of the ramshackle building 200 yards up the street. Clark looked through his binoculars through the rain.
"It's 10:30. Is it bedtime?" Clark asked Chavez.
"Maybe so."
Moments later, a Renault van passed Clark and Chavez's position. It slowed at the target building and then pulled to the front door and stopped.
"Maybe not," said Chavez now,
and he readied his camera on the monopod, focused it on the area of light near the back door. A minute later, a man exited the lobby of the building, walked directly to the light on the wall by the door, and unscrewed the bare bulb. The entire scene went dark.
"Son of a bitch," muttered Chavez.
Clark kept his eyes on his thermal binoculars, and they picked up the white-hot silhouette of the man who'd unscrewed the light bulb as he walked down to the street and shook the hand of the driver of the Renault. He then spoke into a mobile phone, and soon four more ethereal silhouettes appeared from the back door of the dark building. Chavez had given up on his camera for now, and instead he held a thermal monocular up to his eye. He saw the ghostly white figures exiting the building, and could tell they were four men, and he could see they pulled rolling bags and carried briefcases.
"Can you ID Rocky?" Chavez asked.
"Not positively through these thermal optics," said Clark.
What he could discern, although just barely, was that the four men with the luggage all wore suits and ties. The driver of the van and the man who'd unscrewed the light bulb helped the four travelers get their bags into the back of the vehicle. The interior light came on as they opened the tailgate. It wasn't enough light for long-range camera work, but the two Americans were able to get a better look at the men and their luggage.
Is that Louis Vuitton?
Chavez asked, his eyes peering through his camera's high-powered lens.
I wouldn't know, admitted Clark.
Patsy made me look at handbags for 2 hours in London once. I'm pretty sure that's the same design. Even Louis Vuitton handbags can run over a grand. Can't imagine how much those big rolling suitcases go for.
The four men climbed efficiently into the van. They moved like a team as they found their seats and shut the door, extinguishing the lights.
The tallest guy looks like he could be Hosni Roki, but I can't be certain, Clark said.
Whoever they are, they look like they're heading back to Charles de Gaulle.
Maybe, said Clark. But it seems odd Hosni would fly into town just to meet up with three guys, then fly right back out. I think something else is going on.
Chavez said,
This time of night, there's no way we can tail them without being compromised. If these jokers are any good, they're going to spot us. It's a shame we don't have any more vehicles to split up the coverage.
Clark looked ahead to the entrance of the parking lot where Chavez had noticed the surveillance team during his recon.
Maybe we do.
If the French have a fixed surveillance operation around the target, then I'm willing to bet they have a mobile surveillance operation ready to go.
Maybe we can just piggyback on them.
What do you mean?
I'm thinking we can stay back, away from the target, and do our best to pick out the vehicles following him. If we can manage to stay behind the DCRI banking car, we can follow the target without being spotted.
So we tail the tail?
Right. You up for it?
Ding Chavez just nodded.
Sounds like fun.
The Renault van with the driver and the four men in suits turned around in the street and began heading back in Chavez and Clark's direction. The Americans sat patiently as the vehicle passed. They did not start their vehicle. Instead, they just packed up their gear and waited for the van to turn left some 75 yards behind them. Both men knew what to expect next.
Here we go, said Chavez calmly. Let's see who's working the night shift at DCRI.
For a moment, all was still on the dark street, until one by one, the headlights of three vehicles lit up the night. An ancient four-door Toyota in the parking lot of the building ahead and to the right of Clark and Chavez's position. A black Subaru station wagon facing their position, but on the other side of the street, and a good 100 yards past Roki's abandoned flat. And a white Citroen mini truck that faced the apartment 40 yards past Clark and Chavez. One after the next, all three vehicles pulled out into the street and turned down three different roads, all toward the south. Seconds after this, the beige Citroen with the black couple pulled into view, made a left and then a right, and headed off in the direction of all the other cars. When it was dark and quiet again, Clark still did not start the Ford. He drummed his fingers on the steering wheel for a moment. Ding was confused by this at first, but then it dawned on him.
That looked pretty bush league for French intelligence. They wouldn't have all left together like that unless they were trying to draw out counter-surveillance. There's one more out here somewhere.
Yep, said Clark. There is a trigger vehicle. Somebody who has eyes on the street right now.
He paused.
Where would you be, Ding?
Easy. I like that parking garage that I walked through. If I could get in and out without too much fuss, I'd plant my trigger car on the second level so I could see the street and Roki's building.
Just then, some 30 seconds after the last surveillance vehicle disappeared from the dark road, headlights lit up the second level of the parking garage, right where Ding and John were looking. It was a four-door sedan. Neither of the Americans could see more than the hood and windshield and the glowing lights as the car backed up, turned around, and then headed down the ramp to the exit that led out to the boulevard. John Clark started his engine and then pulled out into the street.
Good call, Chavez said.
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut from time to time.
Roger that.
9. They caught up to the beige Citroen and stayed several car lengths behind it, after determining it to be the backing car, the vehicle trailing behind the lead of the mobile surveillance unit. The Citroen would be in radio contact with the rest of the detail, and all the follow vehicles would move in and out of formation to change out the command vehicle, the name given to the vehicle directly tailing the target. Other cars and trucks would be racing ahead on side streets so they could naturally fill in the slots of the running box surveillance. As they drove, the two Americans kept their eyes peeled, just in case there were more units in the French security detail around or behind them that they didn't ID at the target location. For several blocks, they suspected a brown bread truck was involved in the tail. It wove through traffic and seemed to mirror the movements of the beige Citroen, but John and Ding ultimately ruled it out when it pulled up to a large commercial bakery and parked in a loading bay. They also had their eyes on a black Suzuki motorcycle, driven by a man in a black leather outfit and black helmet. Bikes were great for surveillance work on congested streets, and although there were other motorcycles on the road, they'd first noticed the Suzuki a few minutes after leaving the target location. They couldn't be sure, but both men decided they'd keep track of the black bike. After no more than 5 minutes on the road, Chavez and Clark had their answer to the question of whether or not the target was headed to Charles de Gaulle Airport when the chase car continued on south past the Autoroute du Nord.
CDG is the other way, said Clark. We're heading into town.
You're doing pretty good for a blind squirrel.
Clark nodded, then noticed the Citroen sedan pulling ahead.
Looks like the backing car is rotating up.
Seconds later, the white mini truck appeared ahead of them from a side street. It was now the backing vehicle of the mobile fleet, so Clark and Chavez followed it. The black Suzuki did not move around in the surveillance formation. It just stayed a bit ahead of John and Ding as it headed into Paris. This ruled it out as part of the DCRI unit. A steady rain began to fall as the procession reached Paris proper, passing into the 18th arrondissement. They turned to the east once, and took another turn that led them due south. Clark flipped the Ford Galaxy's windshield wipers to their highest setting so he and Chavez could get the clearest look through the rainy night at the taillights of the car ahead. Within minutes, the mini truck increased its speed and disappeared into the night, but not before a black Honda four-door pulled out of the parking lot of a fast food restaurant and headed in the same direction as Clark and Chavez.
Must be the car from the parking garage, Chavez said.
Clark nodded appreciatively.
This detail is damn good. If we didn't know they were here, we'd never spot them.
Yeah, but it's going to tighten up for them and for us as we get deeper into the city. Wish we had a clue where Rilke was heading.
Just then, as if on cue, the Honda four-door slowed behind a Mercedes that pulled out of a private garage below a luxury apartment building. John was in the left lane, and it was clear ahead of him except for the black Suzuki, so he calmly switched lanes to put himself a few cars directly behind the Honda so he wouldn't have to pass him. But upon doing this, he noticed the black Suzuki had pulled into traffic behind the Honda as well. It was an obvious move to stay behind the DCRI backing vehicle. Both men, their minds wired to pick up on tradecraft much more subtle than a maneuver like this, noticed the Suzuki's action. Chavez said,
"Shit, that bike is with the follow team."
"And that guy isn't half as slick as his buddies," said Clark.
"You think he spotted us?"
"No. He may be looking for guys behind Rilke to see if Rilke has counter-surveillance vehicles, but we've got to be a quarter mile back. We should be good."
They passed into the 9th arrondissement, and the backing car of the surveillance detail changed three times in quick succession. As Chavez had said, with more intersections and stop signs to cut down the distance between the follow team and the target, and more buildings and cars to obstruct the follow team's line of sight, the surveillance crew was having to work harder and harder to stay in position behind their target without being spotted. It seemed like all the chase vehicles were scrambling, with the exception of the Suzuki. He stayed just ahead of Clark and Chavez, as if fixed behind the backing cars. There are three types of counter-surveillance: technical, passive, and active. Technical counter-surveillance meant, normally, electronic means, such as the target using radio scanners to listen for short-range radio traffic from a surveillance detail. It was the most rare form of counter-surveillance, as encrypted digital radios were the norm these days, and picking up transmissions was nearly impossible without special equipment and a good deal of time. Passive counter-surveillance was the easiest to employ, as it required nothing more than the target's eyes and knowledge of what kinds of cars and methods will be used against them. The Renault target vehicle would be employing passive counter-surveillance measures, as it was certainly full of men with their eyes peeled for a tail. But passive was also the easiest to defeat, because a large surveillance fleet could move their vehicles around in a pattern that meant no one vehicle would spend much time close enough to be spotted. Active counter-surveillance meant just that, performing some action to draw out any surveillance tail. If the Renault pulled to the side of the road quickly, any followers would have to either stop or drive on by, possibly compromising their mission. If the Renault started going down quiet side streets or alleys or driving through parking lots, any followers would have to reveal themselves to stay with the target. But neither of these active measures were the worst-case scenario for a following force. No, the worst-case scenario was exactly what happened to the DCRI unit Clark and Chavez tailed right as they passed into the 8th arrondissement.
"Heads up!"
Chavez shouted when he saw the DCRI's Subaru station wagon pull too quickly to the side of the road and then turn down a narrow alley. There was no reason for the backing car to make such a